sharpened. Putting down his drink, he explained that he had a long-standing connection with a former East India man who controlled an opium poppy plantation in Bengal. If Pritchard was in need of opium, Carver could guarantee a product of unrivaled quality and limitless supply. At that time, Pritchard had no stock of opium at all, save for some weak tinctures of laudanum he had purchased from a quack. Without hesitation, therefore, he thanked Carver, shook his hand, and agreed to return the following morning to draw up the terms of their trade. Since then, Carver had supplied him with a total of 3 pounds of opium. He would not supply Pritchard with more than 1 pound at a time, for the reason, as he very frankly explained, that he liked to keep a very tight hold on his own supply in order to prevent Pritchard from selling the drug wholesale to other sellers and making an intermediary profit that way. In selling opium to our souk, Pritchard was of course doing exactly this, but Carver remained unaware of this auxiliary arrangement, for he was seldom in Hokitika, and Pritchard had not troubled himself to confess it. The resin came wrapped in paper, pressed into a tin box not unlike a caddy for storing tea. Pritchard picked up a clout from the laboratory bench and began to clean the dirt from beneath his fingernails, noticing as he did so that they were getting rather long. Would Carver really have dared to poison the drug before he sold it wholesale to a drug emporium? Pritchard might have powdered the resin and turned it into laudanum. He might have sold it piecemeal to any number of clients. He might have used the drug himself. It was true that Carver had an unpleasant history with Anna. He had harmed her badly once before. But even if he wished to kill her by overdose, there was no guarantee that a portion of the poisoned opium would end up in Anna's hands. Pritchard rolled a ball of dirt between his fingers. No, it was absurd to think that any man would devise a plot that comprised so many uncertainties. Carver might be a brute, but he was not a fool. Having rejected that theory, the chemist now considered the second option, that the drug had been poisoned after Anna Wetherill was given a piece of it by our souk to take it home. Perhaps someone had stolen into her rooms at the Gridiron and poisoned it there. But again, why? Why bother to poison the opium at all? Why not kill the whore by more conventional means? By strangulation, or smothering, or battery? Defeated, Pritchard turned his mind instead to the things he knew by instinct to be true. He knew that Anna Wetherill had not told the whole truth about the events of the 14th of January. He knew that someone had partaken of the drug recently from the pipe she had hidden in her room. He knew that she had ceased to take opium herself. By her eyes and emotions, he could not doubt that she was as dry as a bone. These certainties, in Pritchard's eyes, could only point to one conclusion. "Hang it all," he whispered. "She's lying. And on another man's behalf." So the afternoon wore on. In time, Pritchard picked up his unfinished orders, and, for want of a more diverting occupation, began to work. He was not aware of the passing of the hours until a gentle knock at the laboratory door returned him to the present. He turned, noting with a dim surprise that the light had become very thin and dusk was approaching, and saw Albert, Nielsen's junior clerk, hovering in the doorway with his breath caught in his chest and an abashed look upon his face. He was carrying a note. "Oh, something from Nielsen," Pritchard said, coming forward. He had quite forgotten his conversation with Nielsen earlier that afternoon and the request he had made of him, to find the goldsmith Kui and to question him regarding the retorted gold that had been discovered on Crosby Wells' estate. He had forgotten about Crosby Wells entirely, and his fortune, and his widow, and the vanished Mr. Staines. How silently the world revolved when one was brooding and alone. Pritchard was fishing in his apron for a sixpence, but Albert, blushing furiously, stammered, "No, sir," and held up his palms to show that the honour of having made the delivery was quite sufficient to sustain him. In fact, Albert was sure he had never had so exciting an afternoon in all his life. His employer, upon returning from Canyeri Chinatown some half-hour previous, had been in such a state of agitation that he had almost torn the door from its hinges. He had penned the note that Albert was carrying now with all the passion of a symphonic composer in collusion with his muse. He had sealed it badly, dropped wax upon himself, cursed, and then thrust the folded lumpy sheet at Albert, saying hoarsely, "Pritchard! To Pritchard, quick as you can!" In the privacy of the chemist's receiving room, just before he entered the laboratory, Albert had pinched the edges of the letter together to make the folded paper form a kind of tube, and by squinting down its length he had made out several words that seemed to him to smack of the gravest piracy. It thrilled him that his employer was up to no good. "Very well, then." "Thanks," Pritchard said, taking the letter. "Did he say a reply was needed?"
The boy said, "There's not to be a reply, sir, but he said to stay and watch you burn it after you'd read it through."
Pritchard gave a snort of laughter. This was so like Nielsen. First he sulked, and then he complained of the messiness of it all, and then he dallied, and then he tried to remove all the burden of responsibility from himself. But as soon as he became a participant, as soon as he felt crucial and impressive, then everything became a pantomime, a cloak-and-dagger show. He gloried in it. Pritchard walked away a few paces. The boy looked disappointed, tore the seal with his fingers, and flattened the paper upon his laboratory desk. The letter read,
"Joe, called on Kui as per your request. You are right about the gold. His work. Though he swears he has no notion how the stuff ended up with Wells. The horse mixed up in it all. Perhaps you knew that already, though we can't quite get to the bottom of it. The author, to use your phrase. Seems every man is implicated as we are, peripherally. Too much to set down here. I proposed a council. Orientals, too. We meet in the back room of the Crown at sunset. We'll ensure our council not disturbed. Tell no one, not even if you trust them and they are connected and may one day stand beside us as accused. Be so good as to destroy this. H.N.
Moon in Taurus waxing, in which Charlie Frost forms a hunch, Dick Mannering buckles on his holsters, and we venture upriver to the Canieri claims. Thomas Balfour's inquiry at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand that morning had piqued the banker's curiosity on several fronts, and as soon as the former had left the building, Mr. Frost immediately resolved to do some inquiring of his own. He was still holding in his hand the shares profile of the